As President Obama talked about what government can do to boost job growth and American competitiveness, he got some bad news today. The country's finances are in worse shape than previously thought. The Congressional Budget Office forecast a record federal deficit of $1.5 trillion for this year. NPR economics correspondent John Idsty joins me to talk about the CBO's deficit forecast. And John, the president last night said the economy is improving. So how to explain then the higher deficit for this year?
Well, the big reason is the agreement between the president and Republicans during the lame duck session of Congress to extend the Bush tax cuts for another 2 years. The CBO estimates that will reduce tax revenue by about $400 billion next year. And that represents a huge chunk of this projected record deficit. The CBO did say that those tax cuts are likely to help boost economic growth next year. So they're predicting the deficit will drop some in 2012, but it would remain above $1 trillion.
John, last night in the State of the Union, the president proposed a 5-year freeze on non-security portions of the federal budget to help with the deficit problem. First of all, what is that non-security portion of the budget, and how much of a difference will a 5-year freeze make in that sector?
Well, under the administration's definition, the non-security part of the budget includes all discretionary spending except spending on defense, homeland security, the State Department, and Veterans Affairs. It also excludes entitlements like Medicare and Social Security. So as the president admitted last night, the freeze only applies to 12% of the overall budget.
Right.
Now, according to the White House, the freeze will save more than $400 billion over 10 years, so around $40 billion a year, but not a lot when you're trying to fight annual budget deficits of more than $1 trillion.
And another thing, John, the president talked about last night was the expansion of a number of programs, including clean energy, high-speed rail. All of those would seem to be non-security spending. So how do you increase spending on those programs under the freeze that he's talking about?
Well, the president will do it by cutting spending for other programs in the category. This is not an across-the-board freeze. Every program will not be treated the same. The administration will be prioritizing, so some programs like high-speed rail will get more money and others will get less. And we'll find out more about the trade-offs when the president unveils his 2012 budget in a couple of weeks. But the White House says that all of the spending on the jobs and competitiveness programs that the president talked about last night will be done within the context of the freeze and won't increase the deficit.
Now, at the same time the president is talking about this freeze on discretionary spending, Republicans are also talking about budget cuts. How do those compare?
Well, the Republicans would cut more deeply. The Republican leadership plan is to go back to spending levels in 2008. That would be a 30% reduction across the board in the non-security federal spending immediately. Some Republicans, including members of the Republican Study Group, want to cut even more. But again, we're talking about making cuts in a small category of overall government spending, so it's not going to solve the country's deficit problem. That's going to require tackling spending on Medicare especially and, to a lesser extent, Social Security.
And those perennial third rails
exactly.
of politics likely to happen?
Well, the president did say last night, and this is a quote, "We have to stop pretending that cutting this kind of spending alone, that is like non-security mm-hmm. spending, will be enough." And he made a reference to the work of his deficit commission, which outlined some ways to deal with Medicare and Social Security. But he doesn't appear ready to take the first step at this point.
And a lot more work to come in that department.
Yes.
NPR economics correspondent John Idsty, thanks so much.
You're welcome.
Along with a wave of innovation, Sputnik also spawned a boom in memorabilia, from glassware to globes, clothing to furniture.
There's the Sputnik Blueprint Tile Coaster online for a mere $10, also available as a frame tile for $5 more.
The Sputnik 20th Anniversary 15-ounce mug, a bargain at $15, also available in large for $18.
There's also a Sputnik Anniversary cap and T-shirt available in both light and dark.
A handsome Sputnik light fixture in a modern 1950s style made of polished brass.
And no collection would be complete without a lovely 4x5 photo reprint of the Sputnik 2 dog, Laika, from 1958.
We may not have beaten the Russians into space, but when it comes to the Tchotchkes race, we're going strong.
Well, let's say the fun has just begun. a Sputnik a chip. Spoot, spoot, Sputnik a chip. Is it a spoot, spoot, Sputnik a chip? Is it a spoot, spoot, Sputnik a chip? Is it a spoot, spoot, Sputnik a chip?
Asian Americans have never been a big enough or cohesive enough fragment of the culture to support a whole TV network like BET or Univision, but now online video is a vibrant alternative to television. And that means a fan base of mostly Asian teens is enough to support a new kind of star. Corey Takahashi reports.
At the moment, there's one YouTube celebrity with more subscribers than anyone else. Not Lady Gaga. Not Justin Bieber, either.
First things first. I'm not your average teenager.
More than 3 million fans on YouTube have signed up to receive updates and videos from a college student who was raised in Hilo, Hawaii. His name is Ryan Higa.
As long as I can remember, I've been training to become an ass, an agent of secret stuff.
Higa's latest 35-minute movie is called Agents of Secret Stuff. It's an action comedy set in high school. It features a who's who of YouTube celebrities. The video's clocked well over 8 million views in the past 2 months.
You must operate cautiously. I will not fail. Cool. Peace out.
A Pasadena-based production house, Wong Fu Productions, directed, co-wrote, and co-produced the project with Higa. Philip Wang is a co-founder. And he also acts in the movie.
People, especially through YouTube, they're finding types of entertainment that are just from people that are just like themselves or people that they can relate to a little bit better than, you know, some unattainable movie star or TV star. And so when they see people like Ryan or they see people like us, you know, it's someone that they feel a more personal connection to.
Stars like Ryan Higa can earn up to six-figure incomes a year based on ads YouTube pairs with their videos.
It's not all a Hollywood ecosystem anymore.
George Strompolos used to cultivate online video talent in his former job at YouTube. Now he's working with many of the same stars as a producer in Los Angeles.
For whatever reason, the studio system is not creating, in this case, Asian-American celebrities. So fans of Ryan have actually elevated him to that level through their own means. In this case, that's through YouTube and through the internet.
But even Philip Wang of Wong Fu Productions will admit one downside to this newer pathway to stardom.
We have lost a little bit of that classy kind of stars, you know, from, you know, the Frank Sinatra or Gene Kelly age.
As old Blue Eyes might say, in the YouTube age, it's even more about doing it my way. For NPR News, I'm Corey Takahashi.
It's been a tough week for one of Chicago's most prominent public figures, and we're not talking about Rahm Emanuel. Chicago Bears quarterback Jay Cutler injured his knee during Sunday's NFC Championship game. He didn't play in the second half, and the Bears lost to the Green Bay Packers. Cutler then got blasted by his peers in a storm of Twitter messages that essentially said he quit on his team. As NPR's Tom Goldman reports, that has set off a rollicking debate about the messages and how they were delivered.
Athletes and Twitter. For the most part, says Jeff Perlman, the marriage has been a success.
I almost think more than like really good tickets, what fans want is really good access.
Perlman is an author and columnist for SportsIllustrated.com.
Nobody cares if I'm eating Cheerios for breakfast, but for some reason, people really find it interesting that Shaq is eating Honey Nut Cheerios for breakfast, or LeBron is thinking this, or he's going to that club. And it gives fans a very, very good taste of what an athlete's life is and what they're going through.
In return, it gives athletes a marketing tool. For the estimated 500 NFL players with Twitter accounts, it's a chance to reveal a personality often obscured by pads and helmets. But NFL agent Donald Yee doesn't endorse it with his guys.
It's not really an issue for us because we counsel them on these kinds of things and try to get them to understand the import of their words.
Sunday, a bunch of NFL players, current and former, discovered just how their words, even in 140 characters or less, can wreak havoc. Arizona defensive back Kerry Rhodes watched the Chicago Green Bay game, as we did, with the same selective camera shots. He saw images of Jay Cutler with a hangdog look, out of the game, and seemingly removed from his teammates, all while a third-string quarterback tried to rescue the Bears. Rhodes tweeted, "Come on, Cutler, you have to come back. This is the NFC Championship, if you didn't know. From the Seattle Seahawks, Raheem Brock, Cutler, you little sissy. And from former star Deion Sanders, all the medicine in pro locker rooms, this dude comes out. Folks, I never question a player's injury, but I do question a player's heart. The comments were startling for several reasons. NFL players know how hard the game is. Cutler's not the most popular guy, but his toughness is pretty widely accepted. And, says Donald Yee, only Jay Cutler knew how his knee felt.
Historically, players wouldn't typically speculate, at least publicly, on how another player was really feeling.
Historically, athletes haven't said much of anything publicly, a reality immortalized in the 1988 baseball film Bull Durham, where veteran Crash Davis tutors rookie Nuke LaLoosh on the art of sports cliche.
We got to play him one day at a time.
Got to play.
Pretty boring.
Of course it's boring. That's the point. Write it down.
But Sunday proved how, in the raw, unedited world of Twitter, athletes can be anything but boring, even if it means violating the code of never publicly criticizing a fellow athlete. Is raw better than boring? Fans and reporters might say so. But even some of the players who tweeted Sunday apologized afterwards. True remorse or more marketing? We don't know. But sports writer Jeff Perlman, who at 38 says he straddled the social media generation gap, says he knows how the NFLers could have avoided trouble in the first place.
I feel like the one thing that's missing in communication these days is the process of putting a letter in an envelope and putting a stamp on it, which gives you a little time to think about what you're saying before you say it.
But not much solace for Jay Cutler, who was asked about the tweets after Sunday's game. Sitting in front of his locker, Cutler replied, "No comment on that." Then, according to one reporter's account, Cutler bit his lip as tears welled. Tom Goldman, NPR News.
Finally this hour, we have some news of our own.
Our producer, Melissa Gray, gave birth this morning to a boy, Franklin Perry Argrove, 7 pounds, 4 ounces.
He was born at the same time as our morning meeting when Melissa would normally be entertaining us with delicious pitches.
Today, she had better things to do. Congratulations, Melissa and Jimmy.
From NPR News, this is All Things Considered. I'm Michelle Norris.
And I'm Melissa Block. In his State of the Union address last night, President Obama stressed the importance of education in keeping America competitive. And he praised the turnaround effort at one school in Denver.
3 years ago, it was rated one of the worst schools in Colorado, located on turf between two rival gangs. But last May, 97% of the seniors received their diploma. Most will be the first in their families to go to college.
As NPR's Larry Abramson reports, the makeover of the Bruce Randolph School is still a work in progress.
Just a few years ago, Bruce Randolph Middle School really was one of the worst schools in Colorado, but an ambitious turnaround effort has completely changed the atmosphere. Today, the school is a combined middle and high school focused on getting kids into college. The halls are lined with college banners and awards for academic achievement. The current principal, Cesar Cedillo, says it's been a tough fight.
It was incredibly difficult work. Students were very reluctant to learn, and so we battled with the students, and we stuck together as a staff, and we won out.
In the speech, the president recounted an incident where a student thanked the previous principal for showing that we are smart and we can make it. 11th grader Nomi Rodriguez says students have a unique and frank relationship with their teachers.
The teachers know how to receive feedback from the students. And, you know, it's not feedback that actually puts down the teacher. It makes the teacher become better at their job.
But the experience of this school highlights just how complicated and fragile these turnaround efforts can be. The transformation hinged on giving the staff of Bruce Randolph more autonomy from the central administration of the Denver City Schools. So the president's remarks are a bit of a swipe at big city school systems. Van Scholes, executive director of the think tank Education Reform Now, points out that Bruce Randolph also got a break from the city's teachers union contract.
It's certainly a dig at 100-page contracts that describe every detail in terms of when teachers are supposed to show up, when they're supposed to take their breaks.
The Obama administration has frequently butted heads with teachers unions on these kinds of issues, and there will be more fights ahead. For all of its success, the Bruce Randolph School still bears the scars of its rough beginnings. The city still has the school on an academic watch list. While test scores are improving, they are still very low. Mike Cohen is head of the advocacy group Achieve, Inc. He says that if Bruce Randolph is graduating 97% of its college seniors, that's laudable. But he says we need to know another number.
Not just the percentage of 12th graders who graduate, but the percentage of 9th graders. Because a lot of students who drop out before they get to the senior year.
Like many schools, Bruce Randolph can't say just how many freshmen made it all the way through to graduation, since many transferred to other schools. Many of the school's graduates have been accepted to college. Some, as the president pointed out, may be the first in their families to do so. But most have been accepted to open admission schools, like a community college. Those schools traditionally have very low graduation rates. So many of these students will need a lot of special attention for years to come, or their experience in college could be short-lived. Larry Abramson, NPR News.